right. Okay.
It was a little rectangular.
Good morning, everybody. This is Gail Feldman, who is visiting with us today. So let's go around the room one more time.
I am Madeline.
I'm Ruth.
I'm also Ruth.
And they sit together to make it easier.
Yes.
I'm Gail.
I'm Ina.
Bear.
I'm Dale, and I could go sit next to
Gail.
Gail. That would be good.
Jenny.
Harriet. Connie with Ruth is a middle name.
right. Okay, and Ilana couldn't be here, so we're recording. Somebody else also. Okay. And yes. Okay, so signs of life. What are signs of life? Before we read the story, when you talk about signs of life, what are we talking about?
Breathing, right.
Okay, so yeah, vital signs, right? Where else do we know signs of life from in a not so great, you know, God forbid, you know, when terrorist organizations take hostages, right? And they want, they ask for signs of life, right? The signs of life. So here it's when she dies, you know, first there are no vital signs and then there are vital signs. Okay, so signs of life. Yes.
But also, when you go to a place and it seems deserted, and all of a sudden you say there are signs of life.
Right.
And
right.
I think that's apropos as well.
Right. Absolutely. If we just look at the words themselves without sort of going to, you know, what we know as the meaning, with, you know, the metaphoric potential. Is right here. So in that sense, it's perfect for Rosh Hashanah time, and we'll talk a little bit about that. Okay, but first, Edith Perlman has written about her town, Godolphin. And we're not gonna read the top part of the page, but on the bottom, the top part is an interview of her, and she talks a little bit about Godolphin, where she gets the name. But as she notes in one of the places, half her stories take place in Godolphin, Massachusetts, right? So, but go on the very bottom, it says. Right. So at the very bottom it says, "Oh my Godolphin," by Edith Perlman. Okay, the town of Godolphin, though geographically a wedge of Boston, remember a leafy wedge of Boston, is self-governing by a representative town meeting whose members scream at each other for several evenings every October. Bow-fronted apartment buildings line Jefferson Boulevard. Trolley tracks run down its middle like a zipper. In the town live ancient Yankees, prosperous Jews, envious academics, shopkeepers, secretaries, music teachers, Asian Americans, Irish Americans, Russian almost Americans. A few inhabitants sleep in alleys. Godolphinites exhibit every sexual preference, including the preference to be left alone. You want to keep going?
Godolphin is my domain. I invented it, I run it, I worry about it, and I write about it. Stories with the Godolphin setting have appeared in national magazines, literary quarterlies, Jewish periodicals, and Sunday supplements, and more than half of the stories in How to Fall take place there.
Once an imaginary place has been established in a few tales, it reveals further attributes to the author. She can use them or ignore them or save them for later. Those parks and hills and views and shops and institutions, that atmosphere of good-heartedness and hypocrisy and silliness and rue. New people pop up, an end-of-the-world man, a medium, a monologuist, two mute lovers. The place invites these characters. The characters influence the place.
A writer who uses the same setting and a familiar troupe of supporting act characters can be said to be constructing a continuing saga, a human comedy. More modestly, more truthfully, she is simplifying her milieu, making it flexibly ready for any tale she wants to set there. If readers recognize the town and look forward to visiting again, so much the better. Now the writer has that delightful thing, a following.
And the place itself becomes a collective character, with eyes and ears and with recognizable values. Not every one of them admirable. When Donna Crown and Shield opened her soup kitchen, there was a terrific fuss.
Do we want this element sleeping under our trees, terrifying our children? Gentle folk demanded. Donna and her staff of volunteers went on dishing out meals. And after a while, the outcry died down, especially when it noticed that most guests of the soup kitchen took the trolley back to the city after lunch, apparently preferring dolphins.
The dolphin is not microcosmic or generic. It is particular and peculiar. I cannot bring tanks onto Jefferson Boulevard or make the public golf course the site of a county fair where a man gets drunk enough to sell his wife. But crime can find its way to the town's leafy streets, as can a measure of magic and lust and death and accident and sin. For glitz, high culture, and drugged misery, I can send my
It is a pleasure, this work, the work of trying to render a detailed, physical, and media town, which develops further in every new story. Each small neighborhood within Godolphin is home to somebody or other. Each street corner is someone's hangout. Hanging out with my characters, I am unlikely to slip into abstractions or indulge in highbrow theories. But if I do get smug or careless, the citizens of Godolphin will no doubt run me out of line and hire themselves in
their How different is this from Epstein? Who we
right.
read yes. last week. I mean, yeah. I don't yeah. know if anybody yeah. had mentioned yeah. it. It's yeah. almost like the antithesis, yeah. right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I love it. I love it.
I love that. I invented it, I run it, I worry about it, I write about it. You know, so this she has in common with many of the writers that we've encountered where the characters take on a life of their own. And so the author really is in dialogue with the characters, you know. I worry about them, you know. So this little piece that Edith Perlman wrote on Godolphin, it's a wonderful, you know, it's a piece unto itself. But I wanted to share that with you since we're going to encounter Jefferson Boulevard. Okay. It's either Beacon or... Yeah, actually, probably it is, right? Because Godolphin Hill would be, Godolphin Hill's Beacon Hill. Godolphin is a town in England. Actually, I was looking it up again, right, because I couldn't find it the first time we encountered it, but I looked it up again, and it seems to be like a, you know, which makes sense, because, you know, half the names of our towns are British, you know.
Right. So why don't you choose that one? And I'm looking at it and trying to break it. God is in there.
Go, Dolphin, go, right?
Yeah.
Gadol. Big.
She said in an interview that I heard that it was sort of like Brookline, because Brookline
yes.
is...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. 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 Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. No, no, you can read at your leisure. Yeah. Okay. Signs of life. The question is, how do you know if somebody is alive? We seek signs of life. And so, of course, alive in what sense? So let's take a look. They were not adventurous. No, no. An unremarkable couple. Whenever someone suggested otherwise, they raised four protesting palms in negation as if they were under arrest. Okay, another great first sentence or sentence and a half. So what do we get from here about our couple of Clara and Valerie?
Well, they don't want to call attention to themselves.
Right, which is the issue, right?
Right. They truly want to be integrated in a way that...
Low-key. They don't want to be low-key.
Right. So signs of life is not going to be... For them, it's not connected to somebody saying they're remarkable, right? That's not a sign of life. And what we're going to be asking is, which are the real signs of life and which are the real signs of life? You know, they're the ones that seem like. Okay. As if they are under arrest. Guilty as charged. They really are remarkable, right? Uh-huh. But, you know, as if they were under arrest. They lived in a small weathered house halfway up Calderstone Lane, the street that winds from Jefferson Boulevard to the top of Godolphin Hill, and rewards the climber with a view of the Boston skyline. Clara and Valerie frequently climbed their hill. Also, they worked, gardened, paid taxes, got together with their many friends. Most summers they traveled to a village in Spain they'd discovered just after the war when they were first in love. Then Valerie had seemed to Clara as beautiful as a sculpted boy, taut as a boy, bold as a boy, eyes swiveling like a fascinated boy's, and occasionally possessed of a boy's slingshot straight power to wound. And we get that a little bit, right? Then square-faced Clara had seemed to Valerie as authoritative as a Roman aedile. Now, we had that one in a story before, right? The officer of the city, well, she's going to explain it to us. Val remembered the pictures of aediles, or at least of their busts, in her Latin grammar. Municipal grandees who supervised the building of sewers and roads in the ancient city. So, what do we learn about Clara and Valerie from here so far? There's a lot of information about them packed in. Let me just get the air back on.
Okay.
So what do we get about them?
Well, they're gay in a time when it was not easy to be gay, because it's right after the war.
Right.
And I love the fact that they lived halfway up. I thought that was wonderful. Halfway up. They lived halfway up the hill. They were always in the quiet middle. Yeah.
And they work, and they garden, and they pay taxes, and they have friends. You know, when God puts Adam into the garden, you know, he puts him there to work it and to keep it, right? So, you know, human life, as defined by the book of Genesis, is about working and keeping. And this is, you know, this is what they're doing. They garden, and they work, and they pay their taxes. They also fall in love. And so what do we know about their relationship? So, yes, at a time where not easy to be a gay couple, they are. What else?
What's long-lasting? Because they met after the war, and they're
In their 50s.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Very faithful to each other.
Well, they have some resources if they travel, probably at a young age.
Right.
They're traveling to Europe.
Yeah, so their work generates enough so that they can go to Europe every summer, right? They go to this particular town in Spain, and
Physicality is often described as well.
Yes, right.
It very much so is the way Clara is just more of a masculine, youthful,
and Valerie.
Valerie is more
square.
Yes.
Right, and we're going to hear about their sex life. These are, in that sense, you know, it's all the facets of human life that are, you know, a part of human life, and yet miraculous at the same time, because all of those facets, really, to have friends, to have a partner, you know, this really is what life is about. Okay, let's see. Madeline, do you want to read now Clara and Valerie?
Now Clara and Valerie were in their placid 50s. Each summer they smuggled a bottle of absinthe, and on festive occasions they treated themselves to a thimbleful. They enjoyed legal alcohol too, in moderation, and also in moderation tobacco, caffeine, and the smokable opium they were sometimes able to procure. The year was 1965. Walking was their sole exercise, unless one counted spirited conversation. They made love, yes, but affection had supplanted passion. Valerie taught flute and recorder in the Godolphin Elementary Schools. She was assistant director of the high school orchestra, and she played with various amateur groups. Clara practiced pediatrics.
Okay, so so here we get some other signs of life from Clara and Valerie. What are they?
They work.
Yes, they work. So they attend to the human body, the spirit, you know, music and doctoring.
And children,
right? Children, yes.
Pediatrics and also in the
elementary.
Right.
And
abstinence
and opium. Yes,
yeah.
You can go over the edge there.
Right. Right.
And
there
they're quiet.
They can break a rule there and there, you know.
And those are like really. I wouldn't call. I don't know what the word is. I was thinking sophisticated drugs, or you know, they're kind of high end absinthe, you know, which very high end. And opium, who does opium? I mean, this day and age, all the drugs are so gritty and down the street, but these are very elegant drugs, right?
And only a thimbleful.
Right. Can't have much more.
So when I didn't know what absinthe was, so when I looked it up, apparently it was thought to be addictive, but that was exaggerated.
Right.
Apparently it's not, you know, so I think that
I think they diluted it in some way because it was addictive. Because Paris in the what would be 18?
Exactly.
It was the drug of choice.
Exactly. Right, but you're sure about the addictive part of it?
I bet it was.
Maybe it's they knew information, but when I read about it, it was considered lethal.
You can get absinthe here.
You can get something that's kind of absinthe, like in Europe, exactly, which is why they're bringing it back. The one with the dwarf one.
Wait, we've had absinthe before?
Toulouse-Lautrec.
I'm thinking, okay.
And when they say these are romantic drugs, you know.
This is based on not a solid information.
Right, this is what I think. Yeah.
But I agree.
When they talk about affection versus passion, I think it's a more mature love because passion is that beginning love, and then sometimes that would flit away.
Right.
But theirs is a deeper love because it's now affection and
soft. Right.
I felt it was probably a deeper love than just a flingy.
Right. And we see that. They're placid 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. They're not as frantic as the younger years, right? You know, there's a kind of calm to it. Okay. Ruth, do you want to keep going? The illness?
The illness. It was a mystery. Much that happens to the body is mysterious. Valerie experienced fever, fatigue. The physician verified an infection. Medicines failed to defeat the infection. The fever persisted. Fatigue became exhaustion. Clara and the physician treated her at home for a while with a little corps of nurses. They tried one intravenous antibiotic after another. Valerie sank.
So you know, this is life too, right? We don't understand why some things happen. You know, who could, you know, you can't understand this. They couldn't understand this. We can't. There are so many things we cannot understand. And that too is life.
She was dying, though of what? Nobody could say. She entered a nursing home. That is, she was transported there in an ambulance holding Clara's hand. She did not seem fearful or agitated. These things happen, Clara said bleakly to herself. All doctors are acquainted with inexplicable illnesses and inexplicable deaths. Valerie lay for 2 days in a room 6 stories above Jefferson Boulevard. Clara, standing at the window, looked down at the boulevard's elms, themselves ravaged by disease. Valerie breathed deeply, but infrequently. Her pulse was shallow, but regular. Then she breathed less often. Her pulse became fainter. She died.
Okay, so the boulevard's elms, themselves ravaged by disease, right?
Mm-hmm.
When Valerie dies, Godolphin is also... You know, we see it reflected in the landscape. We're going to see it, everything coming to life when she does.
Mm-hmm.
So she looks dead, right? Mm-hmm. She looks dead, but we're going to find out that she's, you know, either she came back to life or she was just alive all the time. And so, you know, so what's Edith Perlman trying to tell us there?
Well,
signs of life are not so reliable.
Yes, exactly. Right. So you think you see some vivacious character, and they are, they're teeming with life. They might be dead on the inside, right? So, you can't just look at the outside, or even certain signs that might say, oh, this person's alive. You have to go deeper to see whether they're really alive.
Going back, I could see why. There wasn't a doctor there. There wasn't a nurse who was necessarily really current. It was an old, kindly nurse.
Oh, yeah, but dead is dead.
They were listening.
But
I mean,
Claire was a doctor. And Claire was a doctor.
That's true, too. Yeah.
It's interesting that after a life devoted to moderation, there should be such high drama. Yeah. I just thought that was such an interesting flip.
You mean her illness, her sudden illness?
Yeah.
Yes.
Have you all seen Princess Bride, the old movie?
Oh, yeah. Right.
This is almost it. There's
right.
You know, when I read this, right. Because it doesn't say she breathed left often, her pulse became fainter, she died.
Right.
That was their perception.
Right, totally.
But in Princess Bride, they would say, well, this is almost dead.
Almost dead. Okay, Wendy, do you want to keep going? She died?
She died at 10 at night in the presence of Clara and an old, kindly nurse. Clara borrowed the nurse's stethoscope to listen to Valerie's dead heart and the nurse's flashlight to examine Valerie's dead eyes. Then she said she would take a walk. She must leave this place that life had fled from. The nurse tried in vain to stop her.
Keep going.
When Clara returned, she found the nurse hysterical and a Russian doctor bewildered. Summoned to pronounce, he had discovered the patient weak but alive. Vital signs concurred. The two women assured him that an hour earlier, respiration and cardiac function had failed. Recalled to life, he finally wrote on the chart. He was of a literary type.
So, summoned to pronounce, pronounce literally with a capital P here, right? Recalled to life. What is that?
Return from the dead.
Yeah. Return from the dead.
Yeah, but, resurrection.
Yeah, but what is also to recall?
Remember.
A little Zachrinu L'chaim, remember us to life. She does. She sticks these things in there, and you know she's sticking them in there. But okay, recalled to life with capitals. Okay. Gail, do you want to keep going?
Sure. Where had Clara walked that fateful hour? Oh, around the town. She trudged along the boulevard. The trolley from Boston Pass lit up like a nightclub. It carried two passengers. Aimlessly, she paused at one of the bookstores in Godolphin Square. The announcement of its imminent closing was pasted on the window. Walking again, she dodged several automobiles. She noted with sadness that Godolphin, once lively even at this hour, its stores open, its citizens strolling, was flattening into a suburb. Valerie, too, would have found this grievous. Clara sank onto a bench at a bus stop. She covered her face with her hands and wept for her beloved.
Right. So the trolley has two passengers. This store is closing, flattening into a suburb. You know, her surroundings are reflecting what's going on here. So what is the message there?
Well, hold on. But you have a trolley lit up like a nightclub. So is that just like life fleeing, going in another direction? Life's leaving?
Could be. Right? Or when we're in a particular frame of mind, suddenly we see things that actually kind of, fit in with our frame of mind.
Godolphin's decline was one of the many things they talked about during the weeks of convalescence. In their bedroom.
Okay, so you start the sentence with Godolphin's decline, which had been mirrored to Clara as she was walking around. Mm-hmm. Weeks of convalescence. We're back. Okay. Keep going.
Valerie, immobile on the bed like her own sarcophagus, the illness took its time departing from bones and joints. Clara in the tufted chair. Their trees, lindens, were full and fragrant leaf.
Everything's and green!
And yeah. The light entering the room through them was as green as the sea. The robust furniture they had bought in Spain seemed to dissolve in this watery surround.
Even the furniture is robust.
Yes, a bookstore was closing. The elms were dying. One of their friends had fearfully installed
a household alarm.
The town was, I'm having trouble reading, my glasses are not
okay
today.
Barry, do you want to, yeah.
The town was dead, but Valerie was alive. Could they attribute her revival to the various substances floating in her veins? They couldn't be certain. They didn't crave certainty. They planned to discuss the matter till the end of their day. The nurse allowed herself to be quoted in the Godolphin Times, quote, "There were no signs of life," she said. The Russian doctor was next. "Me? I never saw her dead," he declared. "I walked in, she breathed."
Right, so, you know, there are some of us who live unremarkably, and then there are some of us who think that they revive the dead, right? I walked in, she breathed. You know? Okay. Dale?
This is a joke. We were once at a wedding where one of the groomsmen fainted.
Yeah.
I mean, just went down. Okay? And we have a friend who's been in some of our classes who's a pathologist. And she goes over and she signals to me. She says, "He's fine, he's alive." So her husband keeps saying, she says, "She's never pronounced anybody alive before." So that's what I thought about. Me, I never saw her dead. You know, friend, she's never seen. You know, the time they get to her, it's not a problem. Okay. Recovery was the truth. When recovery was complete, Valerie returned to work. One evening on the way home, she looked into the window of Nature's Remedies and she saw an ointment called Vows. In the cafe next door, somebody unfamiliar pointed a finger at her, and somebody else unfamiliar nodded. "Taurus, Godolphin's first." Then there was an article in a Boston Daily, and then a new inn advertised its proximity to the place of the miracle, and then a great number of enterprises opened all at once, like flowers which had been waiting for the sun.
So Valerie, who died, is generating all sorts of life, right? Jenny, go to the top of the next column. So Clara's saying, you know, the next thing you know, we'll have holy chanting.
They're here already, shaved heads, yellow robes. Clara, their music is extraordinary. They're Sogdian, I think. Clara groaned. Godolphin will become a destination. Paula de Tour. Into the honeypot went the finger with all its germs. Into the curved mouth now. Clara stood up, glared at Val, kneed away her chair, and moved around the table and bent to taste those sticky lips. Oh, my love, my living love, what we might have missed. Darling, you have a patient. I have a class. They'll wait. Loosening her robe, loosening Val's robe, and Val knelt, and Clara felt the lips and their honey.
Okay, so, you know, we have sensuality, right, with the finger in the honey, and we have seductiveness, and we have, you know, we have all the signs of life, right? And then during the next few months, bed and breakfast multiply. You know, be fruitful and multiply, right? Herb sellers unfolded tables on the sidewalks, and sold twigs and powders. The Godolphin police were reluctant to chase them away. A new restaurant opened, Mirabile. So all of this is, you know, the unfolding and the multiplying and, you know, everything's coming to life. Okay, Harriet, do you want to?
What could Clara do? She had a practice to maintain. She was, after all, their household's chief support. Besides, she loved medicine. One day at the hospital, she ran into the Russian doctor. He was a cardiologist, it turned out. Over coffee, he told her that his own practice was flourishing. "For years, I nearly starved," he said. "Now they run to me, the congestives, the infarcts. And you know what?
And he leaned forward until his big nose almost touched hers. A lot of them I make better.
So all of these, now what's interesting is, right, because of Valerie, you know, it's going to become a destination, and all of these signs of life, are they really going to be signs of life? Because they have the potential to transform this this town into something, you know, that's dead and, you know, touristy and, you know, just, right. Well, a little notoriety, then renewed confidence. Clara could explain it all. A few successes, more confidence. I have been selected, the cardiologist preened. Okay, so turn to the next page.
I just noticed.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Mirabile. It was a miracle.
Right. Yep. So, middle of the page, Val's saying that somebody wants an interview. Over my dead body. Okay. Connie, do you want to?
It was late at night. Val was already in bed, reading and smoking. Clara was struggling out of her clothes. She had gained weight during this confusing time. Would you really like to be interviewed? She growled, trousers halfway down her fat thighs. Become a thing of the media? Belong to the public? Val blew smoke in that inviting way. Amazing that an exhalation could accomplish so much. I don't know, she confessed. Mostly I want to belong to you. You already belong to me. Mostly? The old arrow. Val could still fling it straight to the heart.
Okay, so what is this about? Because we heard about it, you know, the power to wound, and then we hear the arrow going to the heart. What's going on there?
Something is coming into their relationship. There's an outside force that's taking her away from their intimacy, their low-key intimacy, right?
Right, and the pattern of when there's like an irritation in the relationship is for Clara to growl and her to fling an arrow. And, you know, it's not clear that she knows she's doing it, right? She's just talking, but, you know, if she probably thought back. And that's true, too. Sometimes we wound people and we don't know that we're doing it. But just one more sentence.
It may be that I owe a debt to people of faith, Val.
Why is that so funny?
Well, grandiose seems to
And she's going to tell us she's been touched by the divine, right?
Right.
Balls, you're an ordinary woman who happened to have died. But that's it, right? She is an ordinary woman who miraculous things have happened to her, right? Their gaze is locked. Their 20-year history seemed to float in the space between them, seemed to rock there like a phantom child. And whatever would she have done without Valerie, Clara inwardly moaned while maintaining the ferocity of her expression. The growl is still there. Trying to anyway, but apparently failing, for Val, no longer lofty, said, publicity would be a horror. I don't know what I was thinking. Well, forgivingly, you see, we musicians, we all once wished to be virtuosi. Clara, who had still not stepped out of her trousers, hobbled over to the side of the bed, sat down, and took Val's silken hands in her coarse ones. Such a charming wish. So what has happened here?
Well, the relationship mattered more than fame and glory,
clearly.
And they're able to reconcile the tension.
Yes.
And the wounds, you know?
Yes.
It's a solid relationship where they know how to...
Yes. So Val said, oh, it's just, you know, I'm an artist, right? And we artists tend to be a little bit, you know...
An inner turmoil.
Yes.
Inner turmoil. Wavering a little bit.
Yes.
Knowing who she is, but being touched and just...
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. So she was tempted. And so Clara, forgiving, right? Okay. So bottom of the page... So Val ignored these followers, Lynn?
Val ignored these followers, but during the second summer, the farmers bought a plaster of Paris copy of the statue, which they planned to display each week in a different stall. if you don't smash that thing, she said when she saw it, I will push my collapsible cart to the supermarket at the other end of town. And this troop will trot after me. And what will you do with your mulberries then?
Right. So, another interesting comment, which is there's lots of activity about Val, but activity seems to be a sign of life, but not necessarily, right? You can have a lot of activity happening and nothing going on, actually. My professor of blessed memory, Joe Lukinski at JTS, he taught the one education course that we had in rabbinical school, he taught, but he used to say that you can keep kids busy while they're not learning a thing, not one thing, you know? And we all know, we probably all had that experience. So it's not, activity in itself is not indicative of anything actually happening, right?
The other thing was up at the top where she said, you know, you were an ordinary one who happened to die. It brought Val back to kind of reality, too. It kind of smacked her down. And it continued, though, because she could still have gone back to liking all these people following her around and being a famous person, but she didn't.
Right. She meant it. She meant it. You know, we're on the same page. Okay. And do you want to keep going, Mel?
Several shoppers heard Val's threat. And one who came into the office with a feverish child reported it to Clara. Clara's pen halted briefly over her pad. Then she tore off the prescription and handed it to the mother. "You forgot to sign this," the woman complained. At home, "That must have been a virtuoso performance," said Clara.
So what's going on here? Val wanted to be a virtuoso. She got her moment, right? You know, she didn't get her moment. Right. She's responding. So I may not, you know, be able to benefit from this, but virtuoso moment. Okay. But it's a small town, right? Mm-hmm. Clara's patients are hearing what Valerie's experiences are in the supermarket, you know, so everybody knows everybody. Val knew what she meant?
Val knew what she meant. Of course she did. Gleefully, she handed Clara a brown paper sack from the farmers. Inside was a statue in 5 pieces. "My sweet, sweet," said Clara, voice hoarse. And afterwards, after the long shudders, after the brief slumber, after the playful coda, fingers idly stirring, Val said, "This was worth dying for. Though all I felt that night was that I was turning into..." Yes, Val had not been able to remember, not until now. Marble? No, something slurry with stones. Macadam, Clara recognized.
Did you know that word?
Yeah. Yeah.
I looked it up.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a painting.
It's like blacktop.
With stones, right?
Yeah, it's what goes into the
painting material.
Yeah, yeah.
And they lay the tar on the street.
Right, exactly.
But I never heard of it.
So not a flat line, you know, the dead thing. She's got some stones, you know, so it's not quite. Now, I think it's remarkable. I mean, I know that Edith Perlman has a husband who I think she's had for a very long time, but she's able to write about lesbian sex. I think that's an accomplishment.
She's an artist,
yeah.
Well, don't you think that if the protagonists were male and female, it would still be the same? I mean, it's not graphic. It's very, I don't know what the word
suggestive
would be. It's just very generic.
Sensuous.
Sexy. Sensuous. I think it would apply to any sex.
Right, but...
yeah,
it would actually. But would it... I don't know. I mean, I guess I haven't read enough sort of depictions of lesbian sex to know if this is. But it seems to me very compelling and powerful.
Than passionate.
Yeah.
More gentle. And with musical references in there.
And the finger in the honey pot.
Right.
That's lesbian.
Right. Oh, is that right?
Oh, that's true.
That's it?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. Yeah.
Think about it.
What do I know?
The Madonna picture, the I mean, this is a healer. I mean, Clara's always been the healer in the family.
Right.
And now she's becoming the focus, like a healer, like in Lourdes, like in, and so I think having this be a lesbian relationship and not a male-female relationship just further intensifies the femaleness of the event.
Okay, right, and that macadam is road construction, right? You know, so it's construction. Okay, so go to the right column, which boasted no connection with the miracle. The Fabric Emporium, which boasted no connection with the miracle, but drew customers anyway. Anyway, probably because of the quality of its merchandise. Why is that so funny? Yes, quality is usually what, you know, right. Translates to success.
Right.
But here, it hasn't been that, actually. It's been cheap souvenir styles that's been, you know, so no connection with the miracle doesn't mean there's not life. Brown-skinned men?
Want me to continue?
Yeah, if you would.
Brown-skinned men born in Brazil drove the donkeys. The Godolphin school system made room for the driver's children and for other new children. The high school orchestra thrummed with unfamiliar expressiveness. The town soccer team won the state championship. And citizens popping corks in Godolphin Square hugged people they had never even said hello to.
It's a miracle.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the miracle, right? Uh-huh. That's the miracle. You know, this, you know, it looks like the donkey, you know, that's the messianic, you know, the Messiah coming on the donkey, but that's not what was going on here. Yeah, go ahead.
Even though she doesn't want to be the center, and even though the truth is she's creating beautiful life in people, and a new, maybe people seeing things in a better light, and seeing the town, and people hugging and touching, and bringing in a brown-skinned person, and the children, and she's creating without wanting it. She truly is creating.
Well, it sort of took on a life of its own.
Yeah, she did. Really.
Right. So she, you know, does it coincide, or does it? You know, was there? Right.
In the end, it is creating beauty.
Yeah, but what is it that's giving the, you know, the fact that the why is the soccer team winning?
Because all these new people come into town.
All these new people. Diversity, right? It's diversity that is bringing life to this, you know, and where it comes from and so on, right? But that's the the soccer team won the state championship. Okay. Wendy, 10 years later?
10 years later, Clara and Valerie still proclaim themselves unremarkable. They worked, gardened, paid taxes, entertained friends, practiced their mild vices, made their annual visit to Spain. That season, they indulged themselves. They bought a case of remarkable wine. It came by ship. Valerie arranged to have it delivered in the middle of the night. I don't want to unbalance our local wine shop, she told Clara. I'm still a bit of a trendsetter.
Right. So, okay, so they come and they deliver the top of the next page. One tipped his cat to cap. The other knelt on the ground and kissed her hem. Okay. Gail, do you want to read?
He did that suggestive thing. It was different from admiring the statue or buying mulberries. In the open window, Clara wondered whether any past moment in her life was worth remembering anymore, or any future one worth enduring. For if Valerie had turned into a figure, not to be exploited, but to be revered, to be worshipped, maybe even to be assumed, then she would never lie beside Clara in a double grave with a single tombstone. Their dust would never mingle.
Okay, so what's the difference between this thing and what all the other stuff is, his action?
It's reverent. It's like religious almost.
Right. The other stuff is commercialism. You know, it's, you know, it's like let's make a buck off of, you know, people who might come in. This is the real deal. You know, this is somebody who, you know, for whom this is part of the way they construct their living experience. But what does Clara take from this?
I don't think she really was impressed by it. I mean, here she was. Clara or Valerie? Who are you asking?
Clara. Yes.
Oh, I'm
yes.
sorry.
I think Clara was threatened by
yeah,
it.
She was. Yeah. It was the same thing. She was right. tearing
yeah.
it apart.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think she's seeing what death looks like, actually, right? Because mm-hmm. she's mentioning our dusts would never mingle. But if that had happened to her, their whole life, which was a beautiful life lived together, and then there's the question, here's an actual action of reverence. But the other stuff is, you know, I mean, it's kind of idolatry, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you're buying the little water and the air. You know, in Israel they do this, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you sell water from the land, from the Holy Land and so on. It really can turn into something.
Up until now, they've still been equal partners. This made it different. This elevated Valerie. So I think she's feeling now they're not together.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It potentially. It drives a wedge into their relationship in that it's they keep saying they're unremarkable.
Yes.
You know, for this guy to kiss her hem and show that reverence makes it pretty remarkable, right? So I think Clara, somebody said that it was threatening to the relationship. And, you know, had Val succumbed to it, or it
right.
potentially could
it
create
could.
A situation where, you know, Val becomes remarkable, and then
right.
They're not an unremarkable couple again.
Right, right.
So.
Well, they're not a couple.
But this relationship knows how to go back to equilibrium
right.
so wonderfully.
Right.
The men left. Valerie raised her face. It was still the face of a mischievous boy. She grinned profanely at her lover. Oh, get yourself inside, barked Clara, and in her relief slammed the window so hard that a pane cracked. Right. Okay, so let's keep going. Barry, do you want it in the summer?
In the summer, they often sit in the yard with their few friends still living under a plum tree which long ago stopped bearing fruit. Uh-huh. Almost 30 years have passed since the night of the kiss. They are old women now, remarkable at last, just for being so old and for maintaining independence and health.
Yes.
Although Valerie has undergone several surgical scrapings of her colon, and they have lost count of the nights that Clara, too breathless to climb the stairs, has slept on the living room couch.
Okay. So now they're remarkable,
mm-hmm.
right? Because they've
survived.
They're alive. The tree might not be bearing fruit anymore, but they are still going, and they are still together. Tim, do you want to talk?
They talk sometimes, getting it muddled, the past, the illness, the death, the recall. I just love the word recall.
Recall, right? What's recall? You know, the recall. You know, it's when something doesn't work, right? But here it's the other meaning. Okay.
Mostly, though, they talk about other things. A yellow columbine striped in orange has sown itself in their yard. It reminds Valerie of a cat they love, and she wonders about cross-kingdom mates.
Okay, so what's going on there, that sentence? It reminds Valerie of a cat they loved, and she wonders about cross-kingdom matings. Curiosity is a sign of life. You haven't, mm-hmm. you know, when you're still asking questions and you're still wanting to research mm-hmm. different topics and so on, that is a sign of life. These women are going to live until the end, like really live until the end. Gil, do you want to just do one
the
more?
The boy next door has a rock band that practices in the garage. They listen.
Okay, they might be mystified, but they're not judgmental.
Right.
You know, they're
right.
you know
they're listening
right.
to it.
Right, yeah. right. You know, what is this? And they read poetry to each other. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's beautiful. Okay, last, Jenny.
Tourists continue to come, trolleying in from Boston, strolling under the flourishing maples on Jefferson Boulevard. These sightseers attend the Repertory Theater and dine in the restaurants. At Godolphin Square, they buy books and old stamps and antique buttons. They journey to the top of the hill, some on foot, some on a donkey. They walk around the sculpture garden. Amid new welded abstractions and rough nudes, the statue gets little notice. But few visitors leave town without stopping at one of the booths at the bottom of Cowsder Stone Lane and picking up a pot of Revive, an anti-wrinkle gel, or a bottle of Godolphin Ardor. It's an oily purple liquid rumored to contain opium and absinthe and nicotine, and it tastes like resin. Nonetheless, it's a favorite souvenir. Some people even drink the stuff.
So life is a mystery, but so are people, right? You know, in what they're willing to do. So
I thought it was interesting that the the Godolphin Ardor contained the things of their secret vices.
Right.
Figured out.
Right. Well, as if that's the secret of life.
Right.
There was a mystery to them.
Yeah.
That regardless of how people tried to get in,
yes,
they were able to maintain this aura of mystery.
Right. And what Clara realizes is that, before Valerie was life and death, and she chose life, right? And the death, which was going to be the commercializing of their relationship, or them, you know, being made into this miracle person, you know, again, what looks like greater life would have been death to that relationship. And she chose, you know, to be less remarkable and more alive. Couldn't have had a better introduction to the season. The first side is where there's larger writing, the Una Tanitoka. So this is that famous prayer that we're going to say on Rosh Hashanah, which is so difficult and so hard, but with my father and Jack Reamer's explanation of it, it might help you. Okay, so the left side is the prayer itself, and the right side is their interpretation. So on Rosh Hashanah it is written, on Yom Kippur it is sealed. When we really begin a new year, it is decided, and when we actually repent, it is determined. Who will live and who will die? Who will be truly alive and who shall merely exist? And I think that's really the issue. I mean, it's the issue of our lives, but it's the issue of the story. You know, what does life really look like? Who is truly alive and who are just sleepwalking through that life? So I thought I would offer this to you. And I want to wish everybody a happy, healthy, terrific, wonderful Shana Tova, New Year. So we're not meeting actually for a little while. I believe our next class is
October 9th.
October 9th. Yes, it is. October 9th. Right.
That's super. Nice to have.
Wow.
Yeah, schedule. The calendar, right?
Oh, sure.
Yes, October 9th. So we'll see each other after Yom Kippur, after the first days of Sukkot. Have wonderfully meaningful holidays and joyful ones when we get to Sukkot, and we'll see you then. So our next one is Eyesore. I love that name, Eyesore. So. All right.
I'm actually missed like four in a row.
Really?
Oh, wow.